This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Beth Voorhees at 7:33. Near the end of each month, lawmakers make the trip from around the state to Charleston for interim meetings to study issues and bills for the next legislative session. This month, however, legislators are spending less time studying new issues and more time reworking bills from the previous session. Ashton Mara has more.
Governor Tomlin's call for an extraordinary session showed up first on Twitter with a link to his official proclamation, although lawmakers had been spreading the word for days. The call limited the legislature to six issues, compelling them into session at noon Monday. In the Senate, lawmakers passed two of their three assigned bills, both of which dealt with funding for state programs. But Senate President Jeff Kessler said after their evening floor session, there was a snag in the process in the House.
We ran our bills, got them out of the way through the committee process today. They came out clean, so we decided to run them. I spoke to the Speaker, and I think they have an agreement with the House Republicans over there to suspend the rules tomorrow after they had a night to review the bills and sleep on them.
House Minority Leader Tim Armstead says members received the draft versions of the legislation Sunday, and delegates in his caucus didn't feel comfortable voting on the bills without some clarification.
We had a caucus this morning, and there were some questions that needed to be addressed on those, and so they were referred to the committee. So
it was through that committee process that members received the clarification they were after. But it was a bill intended to raise the state minimum wage that brought lawmakers into this special session, and it was that bill that stalled a Senate Finance Committee meeting Monday afternoon. After the minimum wage bill passed during the regular session, known then as House Bill 4382, members of the governor's staff found some unintended consequences within the new legislation that they say could have negatively impacted many employers across West Virginia, but particularly municipalities. The newly passed state law exempted employers from federal maximum hour and overtime provisions, which could have cost cities millions. Jason Pizzatella, the governor's deputy chief of staff, explains the fix contained in the special session bill.
So what we've done here in Subdivision E is say, prior to House Bill 4283 taking effect, in essence, prior to January 1, 2015, the law is exactly the same for all cases, wage, hour, and overtime. But after January 1, 2015, the federal exemptions will only apply to maximum hours and overtime, not the minimum wage.
Pizzatella says making this change allows the state to stray from the current federal standard. That standard sets the minimum wage at $7.25 an hour. The change allows the legislature to increase the minimum wage to $8.75, as lawmakers had intended, without completely changing the way the state conducts business.
Federal law is very advanced in this area. State law hasn't been updated in the early 80s. You probably could tell just by looking at this subdivision F, where you have things like shoeshine boys, pin boys, pin chasers, terms we just haven't heard in a long time. So that's why federal law has always applied. And so what Senate Bill 2005 does is restore federal law to everything prior to January 1, 2015, and then after that restores federal law to everything but minimum wage, so that the state law, which the legislature adopted, will take effect on January 1st, but all the other federal law remains exactly the same.
The bill does, however, exempt any state employee hired at minimum wage, like seasonal workers, meaning the state will continue to pay those employees the federal standard at $7.25 an hour. Lawmakers will go back into session this afternoon. Kessler expects to pass all six bills fairly quickly and return to the normal interim schedule Wednesday. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ashton Mara in Charleston.
This is West Virginia Morning at 7:37. Becoming mostly cloudy today with a chance of rain and thunderstorms. Temperatures in the 70s and 80s. Rain and thunderstorms overnight and into tomorrow.
Support for West Virginia Public Radio is provided by State Electric Supply Company, your full-line electrical supply distributor, online at stateelectric.com.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is going to be releasing new proposed rules on carbon emissions from coal-fired power plants in the next few weeks. It's an issue of great concern for many who rely on coal for work, but as Beneduccio reports, some also see it as an opportunity.
About 84% of the nation's total greenhouse gas emissions into Earth's atmosphere are from carbon dioxide, according to the Environmental Protection Agency. And much of that carbon dioxide comes from burning fossil fuels like coal. The EPA is taking actions under the Clean Air Act to enforce cuts in carbon emissions for cleaner air. In September of last year, the agency put proposed new rules on how much carbon dioxide future power plants may release into the air. This includes capping carbon dioxide emissions to about 1,100 pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour, depending on the size of the turbines in those new plants. While at this point everything is conjecture in terms of what the agency will seek in its newest regulations pertaining to existing power plants, it is expected that states will have to figure out ways to reduce carbon emissions from their plants substantially in the next 15 years. James Van Nostrand is the director of the Center for Energy and Sustainable Development at WVU.
So there's still going to be a substantial coal industry, but I think there's just going to be a lot of investment in clean coal technology, and definitely the delegation from this state has been supporting an additional expenditures by Department of Energy on clean coal technology, because it's going to be so important for the long-term future of coal that we figure out how to capture the carbon and sequester it.
There are several ideas over how this can be done, but it certainly won't be easy for many utilities to reduce emissions right away. One strategy is to do something known as fuel switching. This essentially means instead of burning coal at power plants, technical adjustments would be made to the plant so the facility would essentially burn natural gas instead, or co-fire coal with natural gas to reduce carbon dioxide emissions.
Some plants, coal plants, depending upon the technology and the vintage, it can be switched to burn natural gas. So a lot of utilities are looking at that possibility. And that's going on now with just the wide availability of natural gas, thanks to the shale gas development and the projections of natural gas prices being fairly slow. Utilities are doing that for economic reasons, irrespective of these EPA regulations. But that could also, presumably, will be a compliance option under these regulations, that you need to achieve a certain reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. One way of getting there is to fuel switch your plant from burning coal to burning natural gas, or you could also co-fire some natural gas with the coal, or co-fire biomass with the coal.
Another proposal the EPA is pursuing is for utilities to use carbon capture and storage technologies. This is a method that involves taking the carbon emissions and storing them underground instead of releasing them into the atmosphere. It's something American Electric Power tried at a southern West Virginia plant a few years back. Essentially, it stored the carbon right there at the site, and the whole project took 8 years simply to get up and running. But it didn't work out in the end. Jeffrey LaFleur is a vice president of generating assets at AEP.
The debate in Congress ended, and they decided not to take up the carbon issue. So, you know, that debate stopped. We got the stagnation in public policy. The carbon issue just really got stuck in the mud. So nothing was moving. Well, when we go to our commissions to get recovery of any cost, they're not interested in paying for technology that's not required. They didn't think that, you know, it was right for our customers to pay for it until it became a rule or a law. So, you know, without funding, we were working with the government. We were even successful of getting a DOE grant, but without any backing from the commission, we just couldn't afford to move forward.
Despite the carbon capture project not working, LaFleur says there are no regrets about that project.
I think we were successful in doing what we set out to do. I think it was a great project. I don't necessarily think we'd do anything differently. I think we would be a lot further down the road now if we would have had a little more foresight on the government's part to fully develop the technology. I mean, the real big debate now is, you know, for new coal units, the EPA proposed rule is you'll have to have carbon capture to build a new coal plant. And because all of this was kind of stopped, you know, that technology really isn't commercially available. It's not commercially viable technology. It's got to be further developed.
That means funding. LaFleur says public utilities that are interested in CCS need the help of the Department of Energy to get more money to do it. But even with funding, LaFleur says utilities, policymakers, and the general public need to have patience because change won't be coming fast enough for some.
A lot of policymakers and the public do not have the patience to do what it takes to be sustainable in solving the problem. The EPA is going to come out with a proposed rule in June. Are they going to give the states enough time to get with the companies to develop a plan? That I think, has been the issue. That, as well as not recognizing that this is a U.S. problem, an international problem, and we need to have the proper funding to really develop the technology going forward.
Whatever rules the EPA does come out with, some in the coal industry are expected to file lawsuits opposing them. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Beneduccio in Morgantown.
Like most extractive industries, the process of using hydraulic fracturing to extract natural gas from shale deposits is often controversial. There are those who tout the benefits gas drilling brings, including jobs and economic development, while others worry about the effects on the environment and quality of life. As Cecilia Mason reports, a couple from Elkins, who specialize in oral history and documentary filmmaking, is exploring all sides of the issue.
With support from the Oral History Association's Emerging Crisis Research Fund, Carrie and Michael Klein are currently working on a project called Pay Dirt, documenting the gas rush in north central West Virginia, a subject they say is highly polarized.
It's moving really, really fast, gas drilling. I don't know if the county can keep up with as fast as they're moving.
We've seen documentaries on both sides, and they're good for the side that they represent, but they're not helping people from other sides to hear one another's story. So we're currently working with everything we can bring to bear to try to tell a story that will help people from various perspectives open up to hearing their own views in the context of others.
You can profit and yet do the right thing for your environment and your neighbors and your country and your fellow human beings.
Little girl by my side, teaching her wrong from right. What she doesn't know is how fast the time.
The Kleins create a discussion on an issue like gas drilling by collecting individual stories, recording each person in a setting and with a demeanor where they feel safe about talking. Later in the studio, they combine the multiple interviews they've collected with a goal of deepening community understanding.
It becomes an extended conversation, even though the interviews were done singly. They are woven into an idealized kind of conversation. So it's a way of bringing together many different views and perspectives in a way that everybody is heard and everybody responds.
The Kleins say the shale drilling project is a perfect example of a controversial topic where all sides of an issue can be explored in one place by editing together comments from separate interviews that represent the perspectives of many individuals. And they've found some surprises in the material they've collected so far.
It's surprising at this point how little overlap there is. We go to Doddridge County and we visit people who are devastated by the changes in their lives. We interview microbiologists who are documenting people who are sick from air pollution. We go to the homes and workplaces of people in industry who are so excited, and we think, could you all visit each other? Because we need all of us. We're all here in this world, in these communities, and we've got to interweave our experience and broaden our understanding.
And become more human in our policies and our vision of a better world. It has to have more humanity in it and more good citizenship. And I think our work speaks to all of those things.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Cecilia Mason in Martinsburg.
Michael and Carrie Klein are also singer-songwriters with the goal of preserving Appalachia's musical history. Tomorrow on West Virginia Morning, we'll learn about that. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Keep up with all the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at WV Public News and find us on Facebook. Support for our news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our producer is Ben Aduccio. Our director is Teresa Wills. I'm Beth Voorhees.